This, to those of you who already heard this talk, clearly the abstract didn't make escape enough people. So anyway, this will be an educational talk with no new results. And its purpose is to present various descriptions, geometric, measure theoretic and functional, of the concentration of measure phenomenon, and to investigate the relationships between these various approaches through mass transportation and hypercontractive bounds. In order to introduce to this question, let me start with the well-known and classical concentration property for Gaussian measures. So let us denote by gamma the canonical Gaussian measure on Rn. For which the concentration property indicates that whenever we start with a set A, we say Gaussian measure rather than equal to 1/2, or any epsilon strictly positive would do essentially the same. Then, if you look at the Gaussian measure of the neighborhood of order R of your set A in the Euclidean metric, it gets very rapidly a mass which is close to 1. Namely, this Gaussian measure is larger than or equal to 1 minus exponential minus r squared over 2 for every r strictly positive, where a sub r is thus the neighborhood of the set A in the Euclidean metric. So this concentration property is, of course, part of the concentration of measure phenomenon emphasized over the years by Vitaly Minman in the context of asymptotic geometric analysis. The point, however, here is that it's not asymptotic. No constant depending on the dimension appear in the statement, which make it a very essential result, which is dimension-free, and which will be one aspect that we would like to investigate more carefully in this talk. So this concentration result for Gaussian measures actually follows from the more refined isoperimetric inequality for Gaussian measures, for which half spaces are the extremal sets. It may also be deduced from the more classical Brun-Minkowski inequality using an argument that was put forward by Moret some years ago. The Brun-Minkowski inequality namely indicates in its functional form due to Prekopa and Lindler that if you have three functions u, v, w on Rn which are non-negative and theta is a real number in between 0 and 1, then provided that for every x and y in Rn you have the w of theta x plus 1 minus theta y is larger than or equal to u of x to the theta times v of y to the 1 minus theta, then the integrals with respect to Lebesgue measure of these three functions w, u, and v are in the same order, namely the integral of w is larger than or equal to the integral of u to the theta times the integral of v to the 1 minus theta. How does this apply to Gaussian concentration? Well, let us start with a function on Rn, say bounded and measurable. And let us apply the Prekopa-Lindler theorem to the following set of three functions. W will simply be the Gaussian density. V of y will be exponential minus f times the Gaussian density. And u of x is given by exponential g of x, again times the Gaussian density, where g is the optimal function that you may choose in order that the hypothesis of the Prekopa-Lindler theorem is satisfied, for example, with theta is equal to 1/2. So this implies that at the logarithmic scale, you should have that, so the log of w should be larger than or equal to 1/2 of g of x minus x squared over 4 minus 1 half of f of y minus y squared over 4. And using the parallelogram identity, it's not difficult to see that the optimal choice for the function g is given by the so-called infimum convolution of f with the quadratic cost 1/4 of x minus y squared. Applying then the Prekopa-Lyons theorem, we see that the integral of w, which is simply 1, will be larger than or equal to the integral of u. So this is simply exponential minus f with respect to the Gaussian exponential g with respect to the Gaussian measure times the integral of exponential minus f again with respect to the Gaussian measure. So how is this related to measure concentration? Well, I simply start with a set A and apply a Borel set in Rn and apply this infimum convolution inequality to the following choice of the function f. You just square everything out. So if you have a set A, you apply this infimum convolution inequality to some particular choice of the function f, and what you may choose is actually f be given by 0 on A and plus infinity on the complement, or rather you should choose a sequence of bounded function approximating this f. And for this choice of f, you see that g, the optimal function g, is given by this infimum convolution, which is certainly attained for all y's which are in the set A, on which f is equal to 0. So this means that the function g is simply 1/4 of the Euclidean distance of the set x, of the point x to the set A. So the optimal function g is 1/4 of the distance of x to A square. And if you read the inequality, what you see is that the integral of g, so that the integral of exponential 1/4 of the Euclidean distance to the set A squared with respect to the Gaussian measure, and this integral here turns out to be simply the Gaussian measure of the set A. So what you get is that this is less than or equal to the 1 over the Gaussian measure of A. And if you start with a set, as in the statement of the concentration principle, with a set with Gaussian measure larger than or equal to 1/2, for example, you see that this is less than or equal to 2. And applying the Chebyshev's inequality, you immediately deduce that the concentration, the Gaussian measure of the enlargement of the set A of order R will be larger than or equal to the same thing as before, up to a numerical constant, 1 minus exponential minus r squared over 4, for any r strictly positive. Interestingly enough, the same argument applies to measures which have a strictly positive density with respect to the Lebesgue measure that you write as exponential minus v, with a potential v that is more convex than the quadratic. So, for example, that uniformly the second derivative of v is larger than or equal to c times the identity for some c strictly positive. So this family of measures will be called strictly log-concave in the circle of the talk. And the same argument, you just replace the parallelogram identity by the convexity assumption at this stage, applies you to show that this family of measures will satisfy a Gaussian concentration similar to the concentration inequality for Gaussian measures. So these geometric infimum convolution thus provide a first approach to dimension-free concentration. And next we will turn to two more approaches to this concentration result. The first one will be functional. So the first one will be functional, and it is simply a useful criterion on Laplace transform in order to reach Gaussian concentration. So let us deal with a probability measure mu on Rn, or more generally a metric space Xd. And for such a probability, let us define its Laplace functional, which is rather the Laplace function of the metric measure space Xd mu, which is defined as a supremum of the Laplace transform of all functions capital F, which are mean zero with respect to mu and one Lipschitz with respect to the metric D. So this is just, as I said, an easy tool in order to produce Gaussian concentration, and namely you have the following rather immediate implication. If there exists a constant C such that for every lambda, the Laplace functional of mu is bounded above by the Laplace transform of a Gaussian. So if there exists a constant C such that for every lambda, the Laplace functional of mu is bounded above by something like exponential C lambda square over 2, then if you apply again the Chebyshev inequality, you find out that if you start with a one Lipschitz function with mean zero, and if you look at the measure of the set where F is larger than or equal to R, it's easily seen that this is bounded above by exponential minus R square over 2C for any R strictly positive. And if you apply this inequality on functions to the typical Lipschitz functions which are given by distances to sets, if you take F to be the distance function to a given set A, it's not mean zero, but it's not difficult to handle the question of the mean in this question, you easily recover from this functional description of measure concentration, you easily recover the geometric form, namely that the Gaussian measure of the neighborhood of order R of any set, say, with a measure larger than or equal to 1/2, will be larger than or equal to 1 minus exponential minus R square. So maybe not over 2C, but over 4C. So this Laplace bound is just a convenient tool to produce Gaussian concentration. Our third description will be measure theoretic. And it will turn to be actually the dual version of the Laplace bound we just presented. So this will be a measure theoretic description of measure concentration through a transportation cost inequality. So again, given a probability measure mu on Rn or a metric space Xd, we will say that it satisfies transportation cost inequality if there exists a constant C such that for any nu on Xd, the Wasserstein distance W1 between mu and nu is less than or equal to the square root of 2C, the relative entropy of nu with respect to mu, where thus W1 mu nu is the Wasserstein distance between mu and nu, which is defined as the infimum over all probability measures pi on the product space with relative marginals mu and nu of the integral of the cost, which is given by the distance between x and y, d pi xy. And H of nu relative to mu is the relative entropy which is defined as the integral of the log of the radon-nicodym derivative of nu with respect to mu d nu, if nu is absolutely continuous with respect to mu, and plus infinity if not. So this transportation cost inequality is the natural extension of the classical Pinsker, Chisar, Kullback inequality that we saw this morning in Kisbol's talk, which is simply obtained when D is a trivial metric on the space X, for which the Wasserstein distance is then simply the distance in total variation between mu and nu. So this transportation cost inequality has been emphasized in the context of measure concentration by Katalin Marton. It's not difficult to see that it implies actually measure concentration and Gaussian measure concentration, but it's more fruitful for our purposes to follow an observation by Bobkoff and Goetze, that actually showed that this transportation cost inequality is the exact dual statement as the Laplace bound we had before. So namely, for a given measure mu, the existence of a constant C such that you have this inequality for every nu is equivalent to the fact that the Laplace bound of mu is bounded above by the Gaussian exponential C lambda squared. And the key in this equivalence is given by the classical Monge-Kantorowicz dual description of the Wasserstein distance as W mu and nu is equal also to the supremum over all one Lipschitz function of the integral of f d mu minus f d nu. And with this in mind, it's not so difficult to see the equivalence between those two descriptions. So, with respect to dimension-free bound, as it is the case for Gaussian measure, one odd aspect of these two equivalent descriptions, both the functional and the measure theoretic, is that they behave rather badly with respect to dimension. A typical result is that if you have two metric measure spaces, x d mu and y delta nu, then if you look at the Laplace functional of the product measure on the product space, with respect to the L1 sum of the matrix, then it's easily seen that the Laplace function of the product measure is bounded above by the product of the Laplace functionals. However, if you use this inequality iteratively, you see that you will produce constant depending on the number of factors that you have in your product, that is, on the dimension of your product space. So this indicates that those Laplace transform or the equivalent transportation cost inequality is not well suited when you are doing products, and this form here doesn't allow you to recover the dimension-free concentration result for the canonical Gaussian product measure, simply because the metric that is involved is rather the L2 metric and not the L1 sum of the metric. So in order to reach dimension-free concentration inequalities, it is actually more fruitful to think about L2 versions of either the functional Laplace bounds or the quadratic transportation cost inequality in order to produce inequalities which do not depend on dimension and cover the case of the Gaussian measure. So let us try to do this. And let us start with, for example, the Wasserstein distance, the measure theoretic description, for which we would like to have the appropriate L2 version. So that's rather easy. And what you do is you simply replace 1 by 2. And 2 by 1. And what you have to do is, of course, to define what is W2. And in order to do this, let me restrict myself to priority measures on Rn or more generally, Riemannian manifolds. And now what you do, of course, is that you replace the metric by the quadratic metric. So in the Euclidean case, this would simply be x minus y squared. And let me put a 1 half here, which is just for convenience. And this is the definition of the W2 Wasserstein distance, the quadratic Wasserstein distance between mu and nu, and the quadratic transportation cost inequality, W2 less than or equal to the square root of entropy. This is, of course, stronger than the W1, simply because by Jensen's inequality, W2 is bigger than W1. And one good aspect is that due to the fact that now here we have a sum of squares along each coordinates, this inequality does indeed well tensorize. Namely, if you have a measure, say, on the real line satisfying this inequality, then the n-fold tensor product of this measure will satisfy the same inequality with the same constant, with no constant depending on the dimension. Okay? Let me also add that the Monge-Kantorowicz description of the Wasserstein distance W1 has an analog for the W2. And what you have to do is, again, you replace 1 by 2. And the proper Monge-Kantorowicz description of the W2 metric is given by the supremum of the integral of g d mu minus f d nu over all functions such that g of x is less than or equal to f of y plus 1 half of x minus y squared for every x and y. So that we see here coming up those infimum convolution we had before in the geometric description through the Brun-Minkowski inequality. And indeed, if you follow the work by Bobkov and Goetze that they accomplished on the W1 inequality, showing that it's equivalent to this functional Laplace bound, if you perform the same argument but now on the W2 inequality, what you get is that the W2 inequality is equivalent to the fact that the integral of exponential g sub c d mu is less than or equal to exponential of the integral of f d mu, where g sub c is just the epsilon function in order that you have this inequality up to the constant c. So g sub c is the infimum convolution of f with 1 over 2 c is the quadratic cost. And this inequality is, of course, very close to the one that we deduced from the Brun-Minkowski inequality in the beginning. Now, let us somewhat summarize what we have obtained so far. So we basically described three approaches to dimension-free concentration. A first one, which is through geometric infimum convolution inequalities. Through the Brun-Minkowski argument. Then we saw some transportation cost inequalities, and more precisely, quadratic transportation cost inequalities. And then we have a third one, which we will discuss now, which is the one that is given by logarithmic Sobolev inequalities. And this will be the proper functional description of dimension-free measure concentration in this context. So what is a logarithmic Sobolev inequality? Again, given a probability measure, say, on Rn, or more generally, a Riemannian manifold, We say that such a probability measure satisfies a logarithmic Sobolev inequality if there exists a function constant C such that for every smooth function f, the integral of f squared log of f squared divided by the L2 norm of f with respect to mu is less than or equal to 2c, 2 is again a convenient constant, times the integral of the Euclidean length square of the gradient. So this is called a logarithmic Sobolev inequality. It is a Sobolev type inequality since you are saying that if the gradient is in L2, then your function is not in some LP space for p strictly bigger than 2, but something degenerates into an Ehrlich space, which is L2 log L. And this is why it's called a logarithmic Sobolev inequality. So if you change f squared into f, you may also rewrite this inequality in the following way, assuming that f is non-negative with integral is equal to 1 with respect to the underlying measure mu, then you may see that this inequality may be written equivalently as the relative entropy of nu with respect to mu, where nu is the probability with density f with respect to mu, and this relative entropy should be less than or equal to c over 2 times the integral of grad f squared divided by f, which is what is known as the Fisher information of nu with respect to mu. In a more PDE context, one may also rewrite this inequality in a somewhat different way, somewhat equivalent different way. Assuming for simplicity that mu has a strictly positive density exponential minus v with respect to Lebesgue measure. In PDE, the reference measure is typically Lebesgue measure rather than a probability measure like mu. So what you do is you change f into a probability density with respect to Lebesgue measure given by rho is equal to f times exponential minus v, so that the integral of rho dx is equal to 1. And if you rewrite your logarithmic Sobolev inequality between entropy and Fisher information, you see that you have to consider the free energy or entropy h of rho, which is given by integral of log of rho log rho dx plus the integral of v rho dx. And the statement is that the relative entropy of any probability density rho should be less than or equal to c over 2 times the Fisher information that may be written as a grad of log rho plus v square rho dx. In this form, the logarithmic Sobolev inequality admits a number of generalizations that has been studied quite recently in the PDE literature. For example, one extension is to replace the x log x function by some power type function. You may also add some further term here, which are of convolution type term, typically coming from the granular media equation. And you may, on the other side, replace the quadratic cost that is around the gradient by some more general cost to reach the so-called generalized logarithmic Sobolev inequality. That are typically used to control the entropy production of evolutive dissipative equation, such as the basic, in this case, Fokker-Planck equation. So if we come back to measure concentration, we notice that, again, due to the fact that we are dealing with the Euclidean length of the gradient square, since we are dealing with the Euclidean length of the gradient square, this is a sum of the derivative squared along each coordinate, and as such, the logarithmic Sobolev inequality is stable by product as it was the case for the quadratic Wasserstein distance, namely if you have a probability measure on the real line satisfying the Sine equality, then the n-fold tensor product of this measure will satisfy the same inequality with the same constant, not depending on dimension. So this is an important feature of the inequalities that we are looking for in order to study dimension-free concentration. So we have thus those three descriptions, geometric, measure theoretic, and functional, of the concentration of measure phenomenon. And what we would like to do here is to try to investigate the relationships between these three descriptions. Before going into this project, a few historical comments on these inequalities. So before the comments, I just forget to say that the logarithmic Sobolev inequality indeed implies the concentration phenomenon. And this is a so-called classical Herbst argument, which is the following. You start with a function f with a mean zero, which is one Lipschitz. And what you do is that you apply the logarithmic Sobolev inequality to the function f given by f square is equal to exponential lambda f with some parameter lambda. And applying the logarithmic Sobolev inequality to those exponentials, what you get is a differential inequality on the Laplace transform of the function capital F. More precisely, if you denote by k of lambda the Laplace transform of F, it's easily seen that the logarithmic Sobolev inequality tells you, if you start with the left-hand side, namely the entropy side here, you see that what you get is lambda times the derivative of the Laplace transform minus k log k. And this should be less than or equal to the energy, to the Fisher information, namely 2c of the integral of the gradient of small f that you write in terms of the gradient of capital F, and that yields lambda square over 4 grad f square exponential lambda f d mu. Now, since you started with a Lipschitz function, its gradient is bounded by 1, and this is less than or equal to c lambda square divided by 2 times the Laplace transform of capital F. And from this, you get a differential inequality on the Laplace transform k of lambda. And if you solve this differential inequality, you see that k of lambda is bounded above precisely by exponential c lambda square over 2, which is the functional Laplace bound that produces dimension-free concentration, as we saw before. So again, this logarithmic Sobolev inequality is a functional description of measure concentration that is dimension-free, that behaves well under tensorization. So a few historical comments on these inequalities. The logarithmic Sobolev inequality for the canonical Gaussian measure is due to Gross in 75. Also, it may be traced back earlier in the information theory literature. And since then, numerous proofs have been produced in order to establish this logarithmic Sobolev inequality. And among them, it's worthwhile mentioning the Bakri-Emery summing group method that allows us to actually prove also the logarithmic Sobolev inequality for the family of strictly log-concave measures we were discussing before. Namely, if you have a measure mu, which is absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue measure with a strictly convex potential V, then the logarithmic Sobolev inequality is satisfied. the quadratic transportation cost inequality for the Gaussian measure gamma is due to Talagrand. Using a mass transportation argument in dimension 1 and then tensorization by the fact that this inequality is tabled by products. And it has been extended to this family of strictly log concave measures by Blauer and Cordero using the Brognier-McCann map that we learned this morning. And actually, as we learned it also this morning, the Brognier-McCann map may be also used to prove the logarithmic Sobolev inequality and even sharp logarithmic Sobolev inequalities and even the Brun-Minkowski or Prekopa-Langlois theorem. So we see that mass transportation is a kind of, maybe thought of as a unifying approach to these inequalities and is the first indication of the close relationships between these various descriptions. In order to go a little bit further into the details of the relationships between these three descriptions, we will actually adopt a point of view that is dual to mass transportation and that is based on the concept of hypercontractivity. So this is taken from a joint work with Popkov and Gentil. And what we have to do first is to describe what is hypercontractivity. So to do this, let us start again with a parability measure with a smooth, strictly positive density with respect to Lebesgue measure. V need not be strictly convex. However, as a simple example, you may think of as the Gaussian measure. And associated to this probability measure mu, let us consider the second order differential operator L, which is given by delta minus grad u grad, which is invariant and self-adjoint with respect to mu, and for which you have the integration by parts formula that indicates that if you take the integral of f minus lg for two smooth functions f and g with respect to the probability measure mu, this is equal to the integral of grad f, grad g, d mu. To this second order differential operator, you associate the semigroup, exponential tl, that gives rise to the fundamental solution of the heat equation associated to the generator l, namely, if f is a function, smooth function, you define uxt to be ptf at the point x, and this function u is a solution, the basic solution of the initial value problem du over dt minus lu is equal to zero with initial condition f. So that's the typical heat equation associated to the generator L. Now, the fundamental result of the paper by Gross is actually the fact that a logarithmic Sobolev inequality for the given measure mu is equivalent to some smoothing properties of the operators PT. And the result, and this is precisely hypercontractivity, and the result is the following. Given measure mu, there is an equivalence between the logarithmic Sobolev inequality for mu, so the integral for all functions, the integral of f squared log f squared d mu less than or equal to 2c, the integral of grad f squared d mu, which is also by the integral integration by parts formula 2c, the integral of f minus lf, for all functions with L2 norm equal to 1. And this logarithmic Sobolev inequality, as a main result, turns out to be equivalent to smoothing properties of the operators Pt in the following sense. If you take P and Q in the following order, and if you let time t be large enough in order that exponential 2t over c is larger than the ratio q minus 1 divided by p minus 1, then the operators pt, which are contractions on all LP spaces with respect to the invariant measure mu, do actually a little bit better and embed LP into LQ with constant 1. And this is called hypercontractivity. Now, the proof of this equivalence consists in the following argument. Namely, you look at the LP norm, at the LQ norm of PTF for a given function f, and you look at this LQ norm with q depending also on time. And more precisely, you have to choose q in order that this relation is satisfied, 1 plus p minus 1 exponential 2t over c. And then you take this function of t and you take the derivative, and due to the fact that the derivative of LQ norm is related to entropy, and by the chain rule, the derivative of Pt is L, you read the hypercontractivity property as an equivalent of the logarithmic Sobolev inequality. So, once you have this argument in mind, it's not so difficult to repeat it, besides some regularity questions. It's not difficult to repeat it, replacing now the basic heat equation by another very basic equation, namely the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So now what you do is to repeat the same argument with the initial value problem known as the Hamilton-Jacobi equation in its very basic form. Namely, you look at V of x and t, and you look at solution of the equation of the second of the initial value problem, dv over dt plus 1/2 grad v square is equal to 0 with initial condition given by f. And it turns out that the typical Hopf-Lux representation of the solution show you that the typical solutions are precisely given by infimum convolutions, namely v xt should be qt of x, qt of f of x at x, which is given by the infimum of f with a quadratic cost 1 over 2t x minus y square, like this. And this actually will make the connection between our three description of measure concentration through this infimum convolution solution of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And now what happens is that you may simply repeat the proof by Gross, replacing Pt by Qt in order to deduce an equivalence between a logarithmic Sobolev inequality and a family of hypercontractive bounds now for the solution of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So what you get is the following result that I may simply write here. Namely, that the logarithmic Sobolev inequality is equivalent to the fact that for any real number r, if you look at the norm, and the relevant quantity here is to study the exponential of qt, and if you look at the norm of exponential qt with parameter a plus t over c, this should be less than or equal to the norm of exponential f with parameter a. So this logarithmic Sobolev inequality, which was equivalent to hypercontractive bounds on the solution of the heat equation, is also equivalent to hypercontractive bounds on the solution of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Now, in this family of hypercontractive bounds, there is a value of particular interest, which is namely A is equal to zero. What happens when A is equal to zero? When A is equal to zero, the L0 norm of exponential F is simply exponential of the mean of F. And taking simply T is equal to 1 by homogeneity, what you get here is the integral of exponential QCF d mu. And this is exactly the dual description of the W2 of the quadratic transportation cost inequality by means of the Monge-Kantorovich dual description. This is equivalent to the W2 inequality so that in particular the logarithmic Sobolev inequality always implies the quadratic transportation cost inequality. So this result was proved earlier, so log sub implies W2. This is due to Otto and Villani, who were using an argument based on interpolation of mass transportation, and we see here that it follows simply from this equivalence on hypercontractive bounds as a particular value of the parameter A. Now, one point has to be mentioned, namely that the converse implication from the hypercontractive bounds to the logarithmic Sobolev inequality actually requires A to be non-zero, so that the quadratic transportation cost inequality doesn't seem to imply, conversely, the logarithmic Sobolev inequality, although a counterexample is still missing. And now, in the final step, we will complete the circle of ideas around this triple description of measure concentration using the Brun-Minkowski theorem. Namely, if we start with a probability measure mu, which is strictly log concave, so that the second derivative of V is larger than or equal to C times the identity for some C strictly positive, then we may exactly repeat the argument we started with based on the Prekopa-Leindler theorem to see that this hypercontractive inequality is satisfied for some particular value of A, namely A is equal to 1. So what you show using Prekopa-Leindler or Brun-Minkowski is that hypercontractivity holds with A is equal to 1, which is non-zero, of course, and capital C is equal to 1 over C. In particular, you see that the Brun-Minkowski, the geometric Brun-Minkowski inequality, implies back this logarithmic Sobolev inequality for strictly log-concave measures. So, I have no time to further comments on this relationship. Let me just mention that there are several works around these inequalities that has been developed recently in the context of mass transportation. Let me mention works by Carrillo, McCann, and Villani that were investigating a generalized form of the logarithmic Sobolev inequality and appropriate convexity assumptions on potentials. There is also a work by Cordero, Gangbo, and Houdre, already mentioned this morning. And in the context of those generalized entropic inequalities, there is a recent paper by Gentil and Malrieux who developed the same hypercontractive approach in this context of generalized logarithmic Sobolev inequalities to show that these generalized logarithmic Sobolev inequalities are also equivalent to an appropriate family of hypercontractive bounds. And in this family of hypercontractive bounds, there is one value of the parameters that correspond to a transportation cost inequality, so that a logarithmic Sobolev inequality always implies, in this much more general context, a transportation cost inequality. But I stop here. Thank you.
First, perfectly beautiful all these connections that I have difficulties to say one pulling point, because all this beauty achieved, exactly, you emphasize this every time, because you care about dimensional free bound. And the concentration phenomenon as tool happened to be so important because of dimensional not free bound. So, in fact, and if you will emphasize this immediately, maybe think you a little bit more apart. So this is independent, extremely beautiful piece and connection. So, for example, with Gaussian measure, it worked because as soon as you only can, you forget about direct product of measure and project this on sphere and immediately recover dimension. And perhaps with Brascom, with Brun-Minkowski, it worked, and in fact, I perhaps understand this because of your talk. Because through Brascom, we emptied both notes that isotropicity, only in case of isotropicity, we may use Brascom leap and receive some concentration result, and isotropicity recovered to us n dimension. So, in fact, every time when you hide this, all application will go the same for one dimensional n dimension. Okay? And I don't know, here is balance, which is difficult to say, but concentration is such tool. Strong that perhaps we sometimes should forget a little bit beauty and return to recovering dimension from dimension of creative world.
Other comments or questions or responses? Okay, if not, so we can thank the speaker.